farm runoff, toxic chemicals, and algae blooms. The Ohio River has it all. So what better place to solve environmental problems? This week on the Allegheny Front, we look at how the Ohio River could be a model for the country in how to clean up polluted waterways.
We can get it done in a place that's had a lot of legacy pollution, both from industry and from coal facilities and mines and things like that. We can basically make water work anywhere.
I'm Reed Frazier. This week on the Allegheny Front, we'll bring you stories from our series, Headwaters, in which we follow the changing Ohio River and its tributaries. The Ohio, problems and solutions. That's coming up when the Allegheny Front continues. Stay with us. Welcome to the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier, sitting in for Kara Holsapple. The Ohio River is nearly 1,000 miles long and provides drinking water for more than 5 million people. But its long legacy as a working river has also made it the most polluted in the country. We begin this week's show with a conversation about resuscitating the Ohio with Colin O'Mara, president of the National Wildlife Federation. O'Mara says his group has a bold new vision for cleaning up the river. He spoke about it with the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple.
One of the things that we're seeing is that there have been amazing investments made in the Great Lakes. There's been big investments made in the Chesapeake, but these investments tend to be in places that are seen as kind of destinations. Folks plan vacations, folks, you know, retire to some of these places. These are places where folks in some cases have second homes, but we're not seeing the same level of investment in kind of what I would consider like the working waterways, you know, places like the Allegheny leading into the Ohio River Valley, places like the Delaware River. 25 million people live in the Ohio River Valley Basin. I mean, that's, you know, almost a tenth of the country. And yet we've seen virtually no investment of federal resources, at least, in trying to clean up the legacy pollution. I mean, the Ohio is still the most polluted waterway in the entire country. So we've been working with some of the mayors, working with some of the different advocacy groups in the region, trying to begin talking about the Ohio River as a system, as a vision for the entire watershed. You know, there's been some good work in places like the Beaver River. There's a lot of individual groups. There's a bunch of groups in Kentucky that are working on the Green or the Cumberland. And what we're trying to do is actually try to unite those voices and actually trying to have a vision. So, you know, folks are as excited about kind of restoring these iconic waterways that in many ways help build our country.
You mentioned the economy. It seems like the most exciting thing that's happening along the Ohio recently is the ethane cracker that Shell is planning to build near Pittsburgh. You know, people are excited about the jobs and the economic development around that. In areas where there's more regional planning around water resources, what other kinds of considerations are part of the equation to value, you know, to how to use the water to create the best future for the region beyond industry?
So often in places that are kind of working waterways, we basically treat, you know, these water bodies as simply a support for these larger kind of industrial facilities. And you see it with crackers or refineries or different places. And those jobs are important, right? I mean, it's important to have jobs. And obviously, we want to be transitioning to a clean energy future and kind of reducing overall emissions. But we don't value the kind of the opportunity cost and the economic loss when you do degrade these waterways. Right now across America, the outdoor economy is about a $646 billion economy. It employs more than 6 million people. I mean, that puts it on par with many of the largest industries in the country. A lot of those are water-dependent jobs related to fishing or swimming or different types of outdoor water-related activities. And so one of the cases we're trying to make is that it doesn't have to be either or. The old dichotomy of having to choose between the economy or the environment really isn't true. And there's places in the country that are making those choices that they want both.
Can you imagine a future scenario where Pittsburgh is more like the Chesapeake Bay, where it's more of a recreational hub and people see this as a viable alternative to more industry?
There are amazing opportunities. It's the reason why Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, chose Falling Water and, you know, kind of the amazing resources just south of you guys as a place to build his flagship structures. And So, I mean, there are beautiful things in western Pennsylvania, and most of them relate to water. And so I think having more kind of regional pride and having greater value placed upon the importance of those assets at least lays a foundation for this becoming a greater priority. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And it's not something that any individual city or any individual, even an individual governor can do. If you can actually build these coalitions, they become nonpartisan in a way that it becomes simply a value and it becomes an ongoing priority. All of a sudden, the typical fights in Harrisburg or the typical fights in Washington begin to subside. I mean, I'll just tell you one quick story. A few years ago, the President Obama proposed a reduction in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding. there was such bipartisan outrage that it was immediately put back, actually higher than what the original budget amount was. Given the political power that's in the region between Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, I mean, you have leaders in both sides of the aisle. You have some of the top Republican leaders in the country, and guys like Rob Portman in Ohio and the Senate Majority Leader McConnell in Kentucky. I mean, you have some of the most important people in Washington that live along this watershed, that if we were able to make it a higher priority for them, there is no reason why significant investment isn't going into the region.
So are you getting buy-in from some of the people you've been talking to about these kinds of issues?
I am. I mean, I think that the challenge is that there's a little bit of disbelief. It's almost like they can't envision what it could be. I'd say I'm getting a fairly lukewarm reception, but I'm not. No one's slamming a door in my face, but no one also is kind of jumping to the front of the line saying we absolutely have to do this right now.
You know, you allude to an interesting point, which is that Pittsburgh is not like some of the other smaller towns along the Ohio River, which are not seeing the technology and innovation. There are a lot of other things going on in Pittsburgh that have helped fuel the revitalization of the riverfronts that may not be happening in other parts of the Ohio River Valley.
I have a lot of friends that went to Pitt and Carnegie Mellon. I mean, there's so much talent, right, in that region, and so much engineering talent in particular that, I mean, I do think that the right kind of spark in Pittsburgh, you could actually kind of light, you know, kind of activity across the entire region. But like you said, I mean, Pittsburgh does have a much more diversified economy than a lot of places that were, you know, mainly depending on, you know, coal extraction or other types of kind of natural resources. I mean, I view this as a great opportunity to invest in those areas that need it most, hopefully give folks skills and economic opportunities they might not otherwise have. If we can actually restore some of the scarring on the landscape from some of the past extraction and clean up some of the mines and at the same time clean up the waterways, you got hundreds of thousands of jobs potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of potential permanent jobs in the kind of wise stewardship of them and through industries and breweries and tourism outfitters. I mean, there's a ton of opportunities if we do this the right way. And there's no reason that there's nothing stopping that from happening other than kind of a lack of focus and a lack of investment.
Why is regional water planning an important issue for the National Wildlife Federation? And why is it a national issue?
You know, when we're trying to address the magnitude of the challenges that we're going to be facing as a country in the years ahead, when you think about, you know, issues around climate or issues around, you know, drought, our long-term salvation in many ways, and I think the economic underpinning of a lot of our economy, could be rooted in our natural resources, and particularly water. You know, it's great to talk about the Chesapeake and the Great Lakes. A water body like the Ohio and like the Delaware is actually more relevant to conversations that we're having in like the upper parts of the Mississippi or in the Missouri or even some of the issues in the Mississippi River Delta. And frankly, if we can show progress in the Ohio River Valley, if we can get it done there, if we can get it done in a place that's had a lot of legacy pollution, both from industry and from coal facilities and mines and things like that, we can basically make water work anywhere. And so for me, I mean, it's not just about the wildlife and the habitat and the short-term gains. It's really about showing that as a country, we care about these resources. And by investing them today, we're going to set ourselves up for, you know, another American century and not simply be strangled by the kind of the sins of the past and the mistakes that we made before. But we can really use water as a way to revitalize communities across the country.
Colin O'Mara, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was the host of the Allegheny Front, Kara Holsapple, speaking with Colin O'Mara, president of the National Wildlife Federation. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Farming poses one of the biggest challenges to the Ohio River's water quality. Agricultural runoff streams into the river and its tributaries every year. Combine this pollution with a good dose of climate change, and you have the making for toxic algae blooms. In 2015, one of these blooms stretched hundreds of miles along the Ohio River and stunned many people living there. But not everyone. As West Virginia Public Radio's Kara Lofton reports, experts are warning that the green slime will no doubt be back.
Ethan Wells has lived along the Ohio River for almost all of his 32 years. One day last August, he noticed blue-green algae growing along the riverbank near his home in Sistersville, an hour south of Wheeling, West Virginia.
I grew up on a farm around ponds and on the river, so I knew what it was.
Each time he looked, there was more of it.
As it progressed and it started to cover the river, it started looking kind of like a neon slime across the top of the river. And it was kind of eerie, in a way, to have the river alive like that.
a lot of people noticed.
The first time the Great Ohio River Swim is now canceled, all because of a problem with algae in our river.
Yeah, there's an advisory against recreational activities in the river.
That summer, more than 600 miles of toxic algae, known as cyanobacteria, was reported in West Virginia, Ohio, and all the way downriver in Illinois. Touching the stuff can be dangerous, causing rashes, lung, and kidney problems. Previous algae blooms around the world have been deadly. So states issued health warnings to avoid contact with the thick, stinky slime. This is the sound of the West Virginia American Water Treatment Plant in Huntington, one of 14 drinking water plants that found blooms in their intakes during last summer's outbreak. Laura Martin is a spokesperson for the company.
At a certain point, we actually enacted our contingency plan for the Huntington water system to switch over to an alternate source.
Since then, Martin says developing ways to deal with toxic algae is the plant's number one priority. During the 2015 bloom, water plants used chemicals to ensure the water was safe to send to customers. But
it's expensive.
That's Stanley States, who was water quality manager at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for decades. He's now an instructor at Texas A&M University and travels around the country teaching water utilities how to deal with disasters like cyanobacteria. He's not kidding about the cost. The water plant in Huntington spent $700,000 to deal with one outbreak on the Ohio. But without statewide or even regional regulations, all the plants can do is figure out ways to filter and treat the stuff.
The ultimate solution to controlling cyanobacterial blooms is going to be control of the release of excess nutrients into bodies of water.
Nutrients, especially phosphates, have been blamed for algae blooms in rivers and lakes all over the world. Phosphorus comes from sewage plants, lawns, and particularly agriculture. There are some 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed.
So if on farmland they use artificial fertilizers, they're supplemented with phosphates. If a farmer uses natural fertilizers, dung, that's loaded with phosphates. So rains wash these phosphates into rivers, to lakes.
When that phosphorus mixes with warm summer water, which is getting warmer as the climate changes, the combination creates the perfect recipe for cyanobacteria to bloom. On Lake Erie, toxic blooms have become something of a late summer ritual. The bloom in 2014 was so big that nearly 500,000 people lost their drinking water in Toledo, Ohio. Stanley State says the Ohio River could also continue to have blooms, in part because of all the locks and dams along the river that regulate flow.
It's not a free-flowing river. It's a series of lakes.
When the blooms took off on the Ohio River last summer, the state of Ohio was quick to respond.
A lot of what we were doing on the Ohio River, we learned from our situation up in Toledo.
Carl Gebhardt is Deputy Director of Water Resources with the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency.
We wanted to make sure that since they had never experienced this before, we were very quick in getting to them to make sure that they were sampling the water before it came into the intake and were implementing the proper treatment.
Ohio has become a key state to watch when it comes to treating toxic blooms. Farm runoff, in general, has been largely unregulated. But last year, in an effort to reduce nutrient runoff, Ohio passed a law limiting when farmers can apply manure to farm fields.
That was a big legislative achievement that the ag community to their credit bought into.
Ohio isn't going it alone. It's working with other states around the Great Lakes to reduce nutrient runoff. Their collaborative goal? Cut this type of pollution 40% over the next decade. Gebhardt says Ohio's new runoff regulations apply to farms all over the state, so it's also expected to keep pollution out of the Ohio River. So far, other river states haven't taken these kinds of steps, though.
Hopefully, West Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Indiana would look at that and say, okay, do we feel confident in our program that, you know, we're doing what we can do, or do we need to revisit that?
Gebhardt says state coordination could reduce pollution and prevent more toxic algae all along the river. And in the long run, that could save water treatment plants money and help ensure safe drinking water for the 5 million people who depend on the Ohio. In Charleston, West Virginia, I'm Kara Lofton.
If you like what you're hearing, we made a podcast with all the stories we've done on this series on the Ohio River. It's the Headwaters podcast.
Pittsburgh, I think, for probably the past 20 or 30 years, has been trying to redefine itself as a clean and green city.
We don't manage the water withdrawals. If we don't manage the water quality, it's going to be very difficult to add people or grow the economy.
Join us for our podcast, Headwaters, exploring the vast water resources of the Ohio River. It's a co-production of the Allegheny Front and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Listen on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, or at alleghenyfront.org/headwaters. Welcome back to the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. Agricultural runoff and toxic algae aren't the only threats to the Ohio. Several communities along the river are wrestling with contamination left by a toxic chemical. It's called C8. You might not know the name C8, but you do know what it's used in: nonstick surfaces like Teflon and flame retardants. The big problem: C8 sticks around in the environment. West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board visited one community where cleanup is costing millions, but some researchers say public health there may still be at risk.
This summer, cars lined up in Vienna, West Virginia. People were picking up jugs and cases of bottled water. Their tap water had been deemed unsafe, laced with a chemical known as C8.
Yeah, what do they want? Bottles? Where at? Back? Front?
There wasn't some sudden chemical spill. The chemical company DuPont polluted the water here for decades. But the federal government says C8 levels it once allowed in the water are now considered unsafe.
Up until the EPA lowered the standard, it really wasn't an issue for us. Once they lowered the standard, then it became a problem.
That's Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp. He's talking about a new health advisory issued by the Environmental Protection Agency this year. It said C8 levels in his and other communities' drinking water are too high.
Back door.
People we spoke with in line have known about DuPont's C8 contamination for years, but they need the chemical company. For generations, it's been the biggest employer around Vienna. Many people, like resident Charles Swisher, are quick to defend them.
It's not fair to isolate DuPont, you know, as there's a lot of people doing things back a few years ago that you know, were unethical, unhealthy. The thing that we need to do now is to be more solution-oriented. We can't go back and change, you know, what has happened.
DuPont is not in charge of those solutions. It created a spin-off company, Chemours, which inherited this environmental legacy. In response to the EPA C8 advisory, Chemours is paying for installation, maintenance, and monitoring of giant carbon filters to clean drinking water. Think your Brita water filter, but on a huge scale. Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp says he has no idea how much cleanup is costing. Chemours wouldn't say, but according to the company's public documents, cleanup has already cost millions, and still, the water aquifer is expected to be contaminated with C8 for hundreds of years. Not everyone is defending the company. Larry Dale grew up around this part of the Ohio River, which is commonly referred to as Chemical Valley. His father and his uncles all worked in chemical plants.
My dad told me, and I'll never forget this, find something else to do, but don't work in a chemical plant.
Dale listened. He's a school bus driver and a retired preacher, but he and his family still live in the shadow of the chemical industry.
You're on the north side of my property.
Okay. Dale stands on top of a hill next to his greenhouse and points to the next ridge over, at DuPont's landfill.
We're actually looking at a northeasterly direction. The landfill itself is that way.
This is where the company dumped over 7,000 tons of C8 sludge. It polluted streams and killed nearby livestock in the late 1990s. Concern over the contamination eventually led to a broad medical study of more than 30,000 community members, including Dale and his family.
My wife tested highest.
He doesn't blame the nearby landfill. He blames the tap water.
It's going to be with me till the day I die. It doesn't just go away.
The study of residents in this area linked C8 to a bunch of health problems, from cancer to reduced immune function. A series of additional health studies followed and further proved that chemical compounds like C8, which were buried in landfills, dumped into waterways, and blown out of smokestacks and scattered across the Ohio Valley for years, well, these chemicals are dangerous, even in small doses.
They stay in the body for a very, very long time.
Dr. Philippe Grandjean of Harvard School of Public Health is an expert on the health effects of perfluorinated chemicals like C8. His latest study looks at the long-term health effects of these chemicals on the immune system of exposed children.
If they harm the immune system today, they probably also will, you know, several years down the road. And that's exactly what we found.
Specifically, Grandjean found vaccines don't work as well in children exposed to C8 at levels similar to those found throughout the U.S. EPA officials say the C8 advisory levels were calculated to protect fetuses during pregnancy and breastfed infants, and based on the best available peer-reviewed studies. But Grandjean says the EPA's advisory doesn't go far enough. He worries it could even create a false sense of security.
I mean, if you drink a lot of that water that is permissible, many Americans are actually likely to substantially increase their body burden of these compounds.
Last year, a coalition of scientists from around the world called for limits on C8 production altogether. Health officials in New Jersey are now suggesting that C8 levels should be 5 times lower than what EPA advises. In Vienna, West Virginia, Mayor Randy Rapp just wants to get the city's water to the EPA's acceptable level.
I just try to live by whatever the rules are. And when they tell us what our water quality has to be, that is the target that we shoot for, and that's the target that we will attain.
Meanwhile, Chemours today isn't using C8. It's using a chemical replacement. Unfortunately, studies indicate that the substitute could have some of the same ecological and health effects. In Vienna, West Virginia, I'm Glynis Board.
That story originally aired in October. There is an update. In February, DuPont and spinoff company Chemours settled a class action lawsuit with over 3,000 plaintiffs for $670 million, plus an additional $50 million a year for 5 years. As part of the settlement, neither company admitted any wrongdoing. As we've heard, pollution from agriculture and industry have created a daunting challenge. How do we clean up the Ohio River? One group thinks it has a solution, a water credit trading program. Basically, industrial polluters buy credits to offset their discharges into the river. From Ohio, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that while programs like this have potential to improve water quality, some say they really just create a pay-to-pollute scheme.
There are about 55 cows and 10 pigs on Kenny Merrick's farm in eastern Ohio. It sits on a hillside above a creek, which leads to the Tuscarawas River, a tributary of the Ohio River.
I grew up next door milking cows at my grandma's place. When I got out of college and bought the farm and started farming shortly thereafter.
Today they sell grass-fed beef and pasture-raised pork direct to customers. They feed the animals and pile their manure by a barn at the top of the hill. It's muddy.
And this was literally, at times, almost waist-deep mud in spots.
The manure and mud used to wash down the hill, mucking up the stream, and Merrick didn't like it.
I needed to change something because we were losing the manure. Would wash off every time it rained. We didn't have any way of containing it, and we didn't have enough space for the cows.
Wash-off like this happens at farms all over the place, and it creates a serious pollution load. According to estimates, there are more than 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed. The Ohio is part of the larger Mississippi River basin, and farm runoff from the Mississippi is estimated to contribute the majority of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, responsible for the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And there's not much to stop it. Agricultural runoff is largely unregulated. Merrick wanted to stop it on his farm. He wanted to lay a large concrete slab for the cows and manure at the top of the hill, secure the hillside, and fence the cattle away from the stream. The price tag? $20,000.
That's enormous costs.
But Merrick heard about something called a water credit trading program. That's where industrial polluters, like power plants, buy credits to meet their pollution limits. And the money goes to farmers to pay for projects like his. Jessica Fox is an environmental scientist with EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, which runs the program.
We started looking into it to try to test out if water quality trading could be an effective mechanism to protect America's waters and to meet company bottom lines.
That's one reason water trading credit programs have been popping up around the country. It might be more cost-effective for industries to pay for farm projects that clean up nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in a waterway than it would be to control an equal amount of it at their industrial plants. In the Ohio River watershed, there are limits on nitrogen, but not on phosphorus pollution. As these nutrients are increasingly blamed for toxic algae blooms in the river, that's expected to change. Currently, in the state of Ohio, environmental regulators are pushing for new phosphorus limits in the river. And that could make those credits, which cost $10 for a pound of nitrogen or phosphorus, more appealing. Jessica Fox has worked for more than a decade on this water pollution marketplace between Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. It's the first multi-state program like this in the country.
The first thing outright is that there's rigorous science and verification to say that nutrient reductions that we claim we are achieving and turning into credits is real and valid.
She's getting at one of the major reasons water trading credit programs have been called pay-to-pollute schemes. Scott Edwards is a director with the advocacy group Food and Water Watch.
We're trading accountability for unaccountability.
His group investigated trading credits in the Ohio River and the Chesapeake Bay. He says these programs have made it impossible to track exact pollution loads from power plants.
A power plant has to measure its discharges at the end of the pipe, report those results. I can tell you, or I used to be able to tell you, exactly how much pollution was coming out of a power plant and into a stream.
But Edward says there's no way to test exactly how much pollution is being reduced by a manure pad or buffer strip on a farm.
That's a guess of what that buffer could do. No one ever is going to measure whether those 1,000 pounds ever were stopped at that farm from entering into a waterway. There's no monitoring going on.
Environmental regulators in New York rejected a water credit trading program in their state for similar reasons, the difficulty of verifying results on farms. Jessica Fox at the Ohio River Project says they use well-established modeling to estimate pollution reduction on farms, and they work with state regulators to verify annually that the projects are being maintained.
I go out there, I go in the farm field, I can see the projects where there used to be all kinds of sediment and manure running right into the river. There is no question that nutrient recovery is happening.
She acknowledges that they can't measure pollution reduction on a farm the way they can at the end of a pipe, but says that doesn't mean there aren't as many benefits.
One of the underlying promises of water quality trading is that you get pollinator benefits, you're sequestering carbon, you're working with local landowners, that a lot of times actually reduces more nutrients than at your wastewater treatment plant or power plant.
Just take Ohio beef producer Ken Merrick. Since controlling the mud from his farm, he's seen the stream come back to life.
My wife is actually catching fish out here last summer with the kids. My grandpa used to do that. I never caught anything. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
This is one of 30 farms that have benefited from the water trading program. They say they've prevented more than 100,000 pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus from getting into the Ohio River. And they have a new round of funding available, this time for forestry projects like tree plantings. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant in Columbiana County, Ohio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Don't forget to subscribe to Headwaters, our podcast, and our other podcast, Trump on Earth. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. Kara Holsapple is back next week.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Benedum Foundation.